Mr. Sidwell, good morning. And I think everybody, twice, you may proceed.
Chief Justice, Your Honor, may I please the court? I would ask to reserve 2 minutes. My name is Scott Sidwell. I am the attorney for the appellant. The appellant is the father of the 4 children, which are the subject of this Lancaster County Juvenile Court action. The Lancaster County Juvenile Court, at the request of the Lancaster County Attorney's Office, terminated the parental rights of the parents in this case after trial. And they did it requesting that there be no requirement for reasonable efforts at rehabilitation to be made. They did that under Section 43-283.01, which sets out the kinds of exaggerated circumstances which are required under the law before a parent's parental rights can be terminated without reasonable efforts. Normally, some type of reasonable efforts at rehabilitation are required under the law, except if you come within the specific provisions of that statutory section that accepts reasonable efforts. Those egregious circumstances are things like abandonment, torture, sexual abuse, murder, voluntary manslaughter, felony assault which results in serious bodily injury, and a more ill-defined chronic abuse. It's the chronic abuse provision that I believe the county attorney endeavored to create the impression that these parents fell within.
So what, your client pled guilty to felony child abuse and was sentenced to the penitentiary?
The allegations in the Douglas County criminal prosecution were on for child abuse, you're correct, Your Honor, but specifically for child abuse that did not involve bodily injury. And I think that's awfully important in this instance, because a plea to that...
What was the factual basis for the conviction?
Well, the factual basis in Douglas County was that the parents admitted to disconnecting a feeding tube on their child Xavier, who was in the hospital, in Children's Hospital. The state tried to create the impression that disconnecting the feeding tube was equal to attempts to starve the child. And, Your Honors, I think that was intellectually dishonest, because the physics of the feeding apparatus and the mechanics of that apparatus make it apparent that they could not have deprived the child of any significant nutrition by disconnecting it, based on the evidence that was in the record.
Well, what was your client's reason for disconnecting it?
They had a disagreement with the medical people at Children's Hospital as to whether or not the corn-based formula, which was being fed through this nasogastric tube, was causing an allergic reaction. The child was reacting badly to it. They had a Neocake trial for a number of days, and that's when the parents started disconnecting the feeding tube. They intended to enhance the amount of spit-up that was exhibited on a rag for the doctors, because they could not get the medical people's attention that this formula was harming the child, was causing gastric upset. And so that bad decision led them to disconnect. But we think the evidence at trial showed that the medical doctors were ordering stop feeds, and the nurses were coming in each day and stopping the nasogastric tube to clean it for much longer periods of time than the parents ever engaged in disconnecting for purposes of enhancing the amount of spit out. So potential for the state to say that it's conclusive cause and effect relationship with the parents disconnecting and any weight loss experienced by the child is just not honest. And during the Neil Cate trial, while Xavier was at Children's Hospital, I think that that trial went on at least 5 days. 3 of those days, the child was gaining weight. It's in record. So the cause and effect facts of...
I'm sorry, you're saying during the course of the trial, the infant gained weight?
There were 3 days during the course of the Neil Cate trial that the child gained weight.
And if were the parents disconnecting during that time frame?
Yes, that's the time that the parents testified that they were disconnecting.
And so they were not present at the trial? They were at the hospital disconnecting? I'm confused.
No, the parents were at the trial.
And during they're present during the trial, and during that same time frame, they're doing disconnects. Is that the fact?
The Neil Cate trial, Your Honor, I'm using that term to describe the attempt by the medical people at Children's Hospital to determine whether or not they could provide the child with a formula that would allow him to gain weight.
Oh, I beg your pardon. You're saying trial period, not a judicial proceeding.
Correct.
I beg your pardon.
Correct.
But did the record indicate, though, that the children went back into the home for temporary and they lost weight?
No. There is some... After Xavier, the child in the hospital, after the parents were removed from the hospital room because they were detected disconnecting, the Department of Health and Human Services removed the other children from the parents' care, and they went into foster care. It's our contention that if the court compares the children, Hope and Sam, the older two siblings, compares their medical record prior to parents' removal with the medical records after parents were removed, you'll find almost identical kinds of symptoms, kinds of colds, kinds of medical concerns exhibited both before and after. If you took away the dates, you wouldn't be able to distinguish the kinds of concerns that these children had.
Counsel, I want to redirect your attention to the reunification efforts. What's the legal basis for that request?
Well, we believe that the law provides that unless the parents fall within the provision with these exaggerated circumstances where reasonable efforts don't have to be made, that the state has to make reasonable efforts to rehabilitate the family and reunite the children with the parents.
Are you familiar with our holding in Duane G?
I am not, simply by the name of that, Your Honor. What I would say in response to the question of should we do that, I'm going to go into my rebuttal time, if I may. In this instance, if the state is wrong, there is irreparable damage to these children. When we recognize in Nebraska that there's a fundamental right to raise one's children, the flip side of that is there's a fundamental right of children to be raised by their parents. So I think that in this instance, if there isn't some egregious behavior on the part of the parents, and we believe there is not, and Dr. Audrey Weiner, who did the only psychological evaluation of these parents, said they were suitable to parent their children in a safe manner, then rehabilitation efforts should be made. We'd like the court to set aside the termination and direct the Lancaster County Juvenile Court to enact a rehabilitation plan that would include provisions to address the parents' issues, introduce the children back into the family home.
Is a finding or a determination of an egregious situation, is that a finding of fact or a question of law?
Well, I think it's a question of law. The facts are set out. In this instance, I think there's virtually no disagreement as to what the facts are. there's a big difference in interpreting what those facts mean. It's like the blind man feeling the elephant. You can feel the trunk and think it's a snake, or feel the tail and think it's a rope, feel the leg and think it's a trunk. But unless you look at the whole picture and understand the universe of it, you'll come to the wrong conclusion.
So you're saying the expert testimony, the experts who testified about the significance of the various facts with respect to reports of symptoms, that's where we need to look to determine what really happened here.
I think that you can look there, but you also have to look with a notion as to whether or not there is confirmatory bias occurring, and whether the expert witnesses have a reason, a motive, that is other than just testifying about facts. Because in many instances, as we point out in the brief, we think that there is. We think there is confirmatory bias occurring. Look at the instance when medical providers change their opinion within a month of giving it. The children's GP had said to the department, this family is okay, they're not doing anything medically abusive to these children. But within a month after the disconnect was discovered, that doctor's opinion changed 180 degrees. How can that be? That's the kind of problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Hupp, good morning.
Good morning. Pursuant to an agreement with counsel for the other appellees, I will be taking 3 minutes of appellee time, reserving the other 7 minutes for the remaining counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Stephanie Hupp. It is my privilege to represent Joanna Langston, who is the biological mother of these children. I'm also a cross-appellant in this action. And the purpose of me using this brief amount of time is simply to...
Actually, we'll give you 10 minutes of time, and then we'll give the county attorneys 10 minutes of time.
Thank you, Your Honor. The purpose of my presentation, though, is to emphasize that on behalf of either parent, we are not contesting or appealing the fact that this is a family that should have been adjudicated, that the department entered, could provide services, that the family could benefit from those services. What the crux of the appeal is that this is not a termination case in the first instance. And I believe the court did ask some questions regarding the reasonable requirements of the department for reunification. And that's the key here, is when you look at the other medical abuse cases that the court has decided, particularly Shelby L., there are ways that you can put a plan into place that ensures the safety of the children and provide services to the parents. This is not one of those cases that's been decided under the reasonable, under relaxing the reasonable requirements for reunification rises to that level.
Are you familiar with our holding in Duane G?
Not by that title, Your Honor. As far as my brief indicates, I do lay out several of the cases where the court did terminate in the first instance without allowing a parent a reasonable effort at reunifying. That case does not appear in that section. But those are the cases in which Mr. Sidwell was referring to that involve a participation in the violent death of a child, shaken baby syndrome, and so on, or a homicide of another child, and then you have an afterborn child where there are no reasonable efforts to reunify.
What kind of a plan would you envision?
Well, Your Honor, I believe there were a couple that were suggested during the course of the trial, and basically it starts with the concept that we had in Shelby L., that there would be a physician assigned, that the parents would be in contact with as far as any medical needs for the children, and that these visitations would start with a general safety plan that we had through the temporary phase of this case, where there would be supervision, there would be ongoing
Is this complicated because are the parents in prison now?
Your Honor, they are completing their sentence, but it is my understanding by the time this case is remanded to the juvenile court that they will have completed their time in court.
Is it complicated by the fact that there are a number of children involved?
No, actually, Your Honor, that didn't seem to pose a problem during the temporary phase. It's complicated by the fact that we had no willingness on part of the department or the supervisors to provide anything other than what was the letter of the court's order during the temporary period. What you'll find the evidence illustrates is, as soon as the Xavier was was in the hospital, and the parents were removed from his room, the department cut off all contact between the parents and the grandparents and all of these children. The court orders a temporary order permitting visitation to occur, and the evidence at trial is that there were no problems during that temporary period. There were approximately 150 visitations that occurred. As far as the structure of the visitation, first there was a juvenile court order, but in addition to that, both the Department of Health and Human Services and the psychologist that was hired by the state put in a specific safety plan on top of the temporary visitation order. And the parents and the grandparents all complied with it. There's no evidence that there was any difficulty there. So I think where we find ourselves at disposition is...
Well, prior to the situations with Xavier, did not your client and her husband have agreed to a plan with the department and then not followed the plan?
It is my understanding that after one of the department investigations that there was a safety plan that the parents were agreeing to. I think there was a very short period of time that occurred through there. But again, there's constant communication between the department and the treating physician, the pediatrician, and the hospitals that the children are going to. So I think, yes, you are correct in that sense. Certainly it was nothing that rose to the level of if you don't follow this, you will lose your children forever, which is what they are faced with. It is something where they were caught in a situation of not being able to get the doctors to listen to them regarding their infant child, and they chose poorly. And we're not making any excuses for that. They have said over and over again the remorse that they have from the interrogation through their trial testimony. The grandparents certainly never condoned that behavior, never were aware that that was going on. And so I think this is
have your clients really faced up to what they did to the other children?
I don't believe they did anything medically inappropriate with the other children. And that's part of what Mr. Sidwell was getting at with when you're looking at hindsight and revisionist history in terms of looking at those other children, with each step with Hope and Samuel, prior to the removal of Xavier, there was no action that they took with either of those children that was questioned as being medically abusive.
When did they plead guilty to?
They pled guilty to child abuse for endangering Xavier.
And you're saying that that's not equivalent to chronic abuse?
No. Because I think what they're missing there is the component of proof of actual serious bodily injury. What they pled guilty to and what they acknowledge is certainly that their decision was foolish and it placed Xavier at a great risk. Not that they caused him any harm.
But the chronic abuse standard in 283.14A doesn't require a showing of serious bodily injury.
It does not. However, in the instance where if you are applying this to Xavier, what we're talking about is a 5-day window of a disconnect of a feeding tube. Again, as Mr. Sidwell said, not necessarily showing that there was any harm, but if you look at that, I don't think at most 5-day period is a chronic abuse. I think you have to believe that Hope and Sam were abused in order for the chronic abuse provision to apply.
You think chronic relates just to one child?
No, I believe chronic relates to a sequence of events or a series of events over a longer period of time. I don't think one particular instance of certainly what would be child abuse and placing him at risk throws itself into chronic abuse.
But the juvenile court made specific findings that there was a sequence of other events involving at least the two of the other children upon which he based his termination decision. So you're asking us to find all those findings to be clearly erroneous?
They are clearly erroneous. They are not supported by the evidence in the record. If you look at Hope and Samuel, the two older children, the conclusions that the court reaches in his order is not supported by the evidence. If you look at Sam's fundification, which seems to be the focal point of any abuse that may have occurred, absolutely nobody up to the point of that fundification said that it was not medically necessary. There are objective tests. The parents testified and the grandparents testified that they were not even familiar with the procedure or what it would do. They did not ask for this. So this is a doctor's recommendation based on the doctor's objective tests, and once it was completed, it was successful. So there are no symptoms. He recovers from a situation, and so I think If you are looking for a reason other than the parents were up to no good, the situation was the child was having gastric distress, the fundoplication was the best medical procedure available, and that resolved the problem.
Is a determination that under 43-283-01 to the effect that something's egregious and therefore no rehab plan, is that a conclusion of law or finding of fact?
I agree with Mr. Sibal that that's a conclusion of law. But I will also tell the court that as far as the juvenile court's order, I do believe that there are clearly erroneous findings of fact that are not supported in the evidence. And if you look at, certainly there are volumes and volumes of medical evidence in this case. My brief tries to highlight some of those instances where if you look at what they are saying, including some of the professionals as well, if you look at what they're saying, it's not supported by the underlying evidence of what the facts were. And so you've got to be very careful when you're looking at some of these conclusions of some of the professionals that are hired by the state, because their conclusions are not necessarily supported by the evidence. And I think for a termination of parental rights, they had better be conclusive. And they're not. They're speculative, and they're drawing the worst inference against these parents that they possibly can, instead of looking at the fact that these are medically sick children. They all had medical needs. And if you look at the timeline for the medical care that all three of these children needed over the course of their whole lives.
Well, what I'm hearing you say is that the trial court credited the expert's testimony.
Yes.
And is that what's our standard of review with such a statement?
Your standard of review is clearly erroneous in terms of the court's factual finding. What I'm saying is if the court is just saying, I adopt what this doctor said, I think this court has the opportunity to look at what that doctor said and make your own determination as far as was that supported by the medical evidence.
What does the record show as how the children are doing now that they're not in the custody of the parents?
Well, there are several exhibits actually that show their medical, how they're doing medically. And quite frankly, it appears to be the same. Xavier had two additional surgeries since his removal. The older children didn't have any major medical issues, but they continued to have the same respiratory problems and allergies and those sorts of issues that took them to the pediatrician. So I would submit to you that it didn't change at all. And we're asking the court for a reversal today of the termination of parental rights, requiring the juvenile court to give the parents an opportunity to exercise a reunification plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Henderson, good morning, and you will have 10 minutes.
Good morning. I am Alicia Henderson. I am from the Lancaster County Attorney's Office, and I represent the petitioner in this particular case. The guardian ad litem is also here and available if the court wishes to ask questions to him specifically about best interest, as well as the issue of whether the guardian ad litem exceeds his authority by sending information to the probation officer at any time. Now, I guess all I can say is what happened to Xavier Langston Children's Hospital in March of 2007 was not foolish. It was not a bad decision. It was not just a misunderstanding or a disagreement. What it was abuse, pure and simple, and that's what the doctors testified. Now, all the medical evidence supported the doctor's opinion that all three of the older Langston children were abused medically by their parents. In other words, the physicians became the instrumentality of the abuse that the parents perpetrated against the children.
Are you saying that the parents gave false symptoms to the doctors in order to create the doctor's impression that certain treatment was needed and that really wasn't necessary?
Absolutely. And it wasn't just that we had medical experts who testified about that after having reviewed the record. I also brought in the people who worked, and you could see that one thing was said here, something different was said over here. Those differences made huge differences in how the doctors were going to pursue treatment for these children. As far as Xavier in the hospital in March of 2007, and you're going to see the video. If you want to watch the video, obviously, it's in the record. It's de novo review. The mother unhooking the feeding tube from this child over and over and over again.
that child is being fed by that feeding tube, and she is dripping out the feed onto a rag and presenting it to the nurse to say, look, my child doesn't like this, my child, he's throwing this up. So what we have is one exhibit that speaks even louder perhaps than the testimony of the doctors, and I can't do all this, maybe you guys can just look from here. I mean, it's exhibit 101. At the top of this exhibit are the weights of Xavier as he's in the hospital in March of 2007. And you can see it just goes down and down and down.
During what age?
He is 4 months old and he weighs 7 pounds at this point in time. He was born premature. The other graph shows the number of times that emesis or throw-ups are being reported. Now, the parents were reporting the emesis. They were not all confirmed by a nurse. So here's the emesis that are being reported. Look, when the Mucate trial is going on, the parents are reporting all sorts of throw-ups by this child. When you see March 30th, what day was that? The day they were arrested.
Pardon me?
The day the parents were arrested, March 30th.
And so
look what
that
happens
right
to this child's weight.
And where are the children or that child when that graph starts?
Still in the hospital, still receiving the same food through the same tube. Nothing changed, but the parents were no longer in the room. The number of throw-ups that the nurses observe, 1, 0. These parents were systematically abusing that child after the Child Protective Services had been in there and told them, you need to follow the doctor's orders. This is after Mrs. Langston had fed her baby, after she had morphine. She breastfed her baby in violation of the doctor's order. That's what she did to Xavier before this. Sam had a fundoplication surgery where they take your esophagus, tie it off on your stomach so you don't throw up as much. All based on self-report. All based on the reports of the parents. Reports that conclusively were shown during the trial, not only through expert testimony, but actually going through all of the records and showing, this is what mom said here, this is what dad said here. They don't match. That's what the doctors were relying on. It's no wonder that the doctors couldn't figure it all out. I mean, if you go to different doctors...
Was there evidence with regard to that surgery that was caused by misinformation given to the doctor about what were the symptoms of that child? And is there evidence that the doctor said, I'd have known differently that the surgery was not necessary and shouldn't have been performed?
Yes. Both Dr. Snow at Children's Hospital, who participated in that particular surgical endeavor, he was not the surgeon, but he was the hospitalist working at the time, testified that that was a necessary surgery.
The surgery was based, is this correct, on reports by the parents, not observations by the medical personnel?
Correct.
Is that right? That's what led to the surgery?
That is correct.
Isn't that a little odd?
Pardon?
Isn't that a little odd?
Actually, no. When you listen to the doctor's testimony, I mean, if you think about when you go into the doctor and you are exhibiting symptoms that are not observable by a doctor, they have to rely on what you say as being true.
But I'm confused. They didn't admit the child and watch for the throw-ups or the spit-ups or the range of things that babies do and then decide to do surgery. It was based on the parents' observations. Is that what happened with that?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that, obviously. The doctors, of course, went through a variety of tests,
right,
which are not diagnostic, but which showed there's some throw-up. Well, if you've had children, you know that babies throw up. So the fact that there's some throw-up that comes up or comes out the mouth shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. All that does is confirm, yes, the baby actually does have...
What was happening to the baby's weight prior to the surgery?
In Sam's case, he had lost weight prior to
the surgery. Okay, so it's not a kid that spits and thrives.
Correct.
Okay.
Now, I would like to talk about Duane G. And obviously, I mean, this was the tip of the iceberg. If you read through the entire record, you also see, obviously, all the testimony about the mother's own mental health needs, her own surgeries that she had, her own history. I mean, it was just appalling. Duane G. specifically sets forth the interplay between the termination of parental rights statute, which is 43292, and the no reasonable efforts are required statute of 43283.01. There is some tension, and I would suggest to you some misunderstanding by people who are in my position as petitioners, trying to figure out sort of which one trumps the other. This court has clearly said that a termination of parental rights can occur at the very beginning of a case, just like this one, that we do not have to do rehabilitation before termination can be entered. Duane G. sets forth the four times that the court is supposed to look at the reasonable efforts are required or not for a court. And those four times are when the child is placed out of home pending adjudication. So when we do a removal and we come to the court and say, was the removal appropriate? The court has to look at, are reasonable efforts being provided to try to reunify the family? May I finish?
Yes, I've got time.
The second is removal after adjudication. So if we've adjudicated a child already and then we remove, the court has to look at what have we done so far to try to keep this family together. Third is at the permanency planning hearing. The time, 12 months have gone by, we're trying to figure out, are we going to reunite, are we going to not, what reasonable efforts have been provided. And the other is when there's a termination of parental rights under one specific subsection of 43292, and that is subsection 6. Clearly, the termination of parental rights statute should trump. That is, if I have proven as petitioner that it is in the best interest of the child and one of those 9 or 10 things is true, then termination would be appropriate and necessary for that child. And I'm asking this court to determine that 43283.01 has nothing to do with that situation. Once we have proven termination is ground and it's in the best interest, we don't even get to 43283.01. That is it.
Thank you. I don't believe we have rebuttal time. We have no rebuttal time, so we'll go on to the